Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, our panel of mental health providers are here to talk about obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Joining us on Zoom, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
In studio with me, social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
And Denise Eggenstack, who is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's treated people with OCD and related disorders for over 25 years and was on the founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute in 1997. Welcome back, Denise.
Thank you.
All right, so let's start. I am so anxious for today's show because I know we're going to learn so much. You know, we all have this idea in our head of what OCD is, and I don't think we're right. So give us kind of what it is and how prevalent it is, the sort of summary, if you will.
Okay, great. So OCD is a psychiatric disorder, and in order to be diagnosed with it, you have to meet certain criteria. And those criteria are laid out in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 5th edition, which is the book we use in psychology and psychiatry to diagnose people. And according to the DSM-5, you have to have obsessions and compulsions. And obsessions are intrusive, unwanted thoughts, images, or impulses that cause distress or anxiety for someone. A common example is a fear of getting sick. And when someone feels this anxiety or distress, it is very uncomfortable and they really want to escape it. And so they engage in compulsions or rituals that are physical, that people do, like washing their hands, or they may be mental, like praying, that are really designed to alleviate the distress associated with the obsession. But it's not just like regular, like, I think I'm sick, I'm going to wash my hands.
And this can be like washing your hands till they're like raw.
Right. So this is washing your hands on steroids. Many people are like, but wait, I don't want to get sick. Like, no one wants to get sick. And if I think I touch something that's dirty, like, of course I'm going to wash my hands. This is that on steroids. So people may use, like, instead of just like a 15-second one pump hand wash, one pump of soap hand wash, it is 10 pumps of soap, washing each finger individually 10 or 15 times. People may have to keep count. And if they lose count, they have to start over. They may have to do this many, many times. And sometimes people feel the soap is not strong enough. It's not getting me clean. They may turn to household agents, even bleach, causing damage to their skin. Oftentimes people will walk around. It looks like they have red gloves on. Their hands are very red and chapped. And it causes, you know, it costs a lot of money, all that soap. It takes a lot of time, all that hand washing, and it causes a lot of distress in families as well.
Is this in the family of anxiety disorders?
So it used to be that OCD was considered an anxiety disorder. Now it's pulled out and it has its own category of disorder in the DSM-5. So it's called OCD and related disorders, but it's a cousin of anxiety disorders. And many people with OCD do have anxiety disorder. So OCD and related disorder. So it's hoarding disorder, which we talked about last month, body dysmorphic disorder, skin picking, or something called body focus, repetitive behaviors, and trichotillomania when people pull hair. Anxiety disorders are more separation anxiety, panic disorder, generalized anxiety. But in the book, in the DSM-5, their chapters are right next to each other, meaning they're pretty closely related.
And how prevalent is it?
So I think it's important to say that OCD spares no one. It is
Have a little bit.
Well, it's equal men, women, and children, and people of all races, ethnicities, and backgrounds. And our best estimate at this point is there are about 1 in 100 adults or 1 in 200 children.
Wow.
And it really can occur at any point in the lifespan, from preschool into adulthood, but we tend to see it coming up in two different time periods. The first is between 8 and 12, and the second is late adolescence to early adulthood. But I've treated kids as young as, you know, 5, 6, 7.
We'll get into that in a minute, but is, I imagine that like other disorders, there's a range of severity, right? So you can have a you can be mildly OCD or severely OCD?
Right. As long as you have that interplay between obsession and compulsion that causes distress, and it takes over another diagnostic criteria, it takes over an hour a day and it impairs your functioning, you can be diagnosed with OCD. But I've treated people that have had, you know, mild to moderate, and then people who have been really, really debilitated, who haven't left their house or take 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hour showers, haven't left a chair in months or a year. So I mean, it's torturous, it's debilitating.
Mark, you always give us the skinny on what's happening in the brain. So tell us, what's happening in the brain?
Well, there is things happening in the brain, obviously. You know, we talk about psychiatric disorders as being brain disorders. But what's really proven with this one, because there's a specific connection in the connections in the brain between three different areas of the brain that are awry, that are abnormal in some way. And the three areas are the cortex, which is the outer area of the brain, and that's where our consciousness lies and our planning and thinking, et cetera. And then two other areas that are inside the brain, subcortical, it's called. And there are two groups, large groups of nerve cells that are used in a kind of, you think of them as a, I don't know, a computer board where things are connected from one thing to another. And there are abnormalities in the connection between these three areas. So it's sort of like a triangle that's connected and not communicating well or being deficient in, I guess you could say, two areas. One would be in terms of like the comparable to the gas pedal on a car, gets things going. In other words, motivation and activity and behavior. And the other would be the brakes, putting a brake on it and evaluating how much you have to care about certain things in the environment. So anxiety certainly drives it. That's why it was, you know, under the anxiety disorder heading. We do have biological treatments to help, but it's notoriously a tough disorder to treat. Even though it's pretty clear what the biology is, it's still a very tough disorder to treat.
And we'll get to treatment in a couple of minutes. But I want to talk a little about how OCD is portrayed in movies and TV. And we were saying before we went on the air, and this is kind of true, I think, of most mental health disorders, that we don't actually get an accurate picture. And it's, and a lot of times comedies, right? We have Monk and then Sheldon Cooper, who probably, you know, is the epitome of somebody with OCD. But we only see one side, right?
Yeah. I thought... Jack Nicholson in As Good As It
Gets
was a very good portrayal of OCD. And, you know, I get nitpicky about it just because it's what I do. But I think very few other characters have portrayed it quite as well. But you did have a good example.
Yeah, so there's a film. I wish I could remember what the film was. It had a woman from Mystic Pizza was the main character, the little Lily somebody. And she had religious scrupulosity, which I'm going to let you describe. But more or less, she was extremely driven by this idea of goodness in a religious sense. And the community, which was very Catholic, sort of turned her into a saint. And it was actually a very sad movie, but a lovely portrayal of that type of OCD that we rarely talk about.
All right. What is it?
Scrupulosity is like a more hyper moralistic or religious OCD. And people are very preoccupied with being a good person or a fear of God, a fear of going to hell. So, for example, somebody that I treated recently that had scrupulosity had to sort of earn food or earn fun or before dinner had extensive praying rituals. And the problem with scrupulosity and what makes it sort of difficult to treat is that it's sort of egocentric, tends to be people who are religious, who care about being a good person. So it's hard for them to have a perspective that this is crossing a line and hijacking their morality and hijacking their religious experience. And many people are just afraid of going to hell. Well, you really can't disprove that until someone has passed away. And so it does become a fairly difficult symptom type of OCD to treat. And it really does torture people.
Yeah. And it feels like when you're talking to those, because I've had a couple in my practice as well, it feels like you're arguing against God,
right?
Which, you know, you don't ever want to be doing.
Right. So sometimes we bring in priests or rabbis or other religious authorities to, you know, to come in and help us with that. And Katie O'Dunn is a colleague of mine at the International OCD Foundation. She has started a whole faith-based OCD and OCD treatment segment.
And this kind of reminds me of sort of this interesting history. And Mark, you uncovered some of this history of OCD traced back to ancient times. And a lot of it was related to this religious, these rituals, right?
Specifically, yes. There were some people in history, actually, the history goes back at least until the 19th century, where it's described in writings. But people would be super concerned about their religion and had doubts about whether they were good enough, whether they were evil or not. And they had to engage in certain rituals. Probably they're not fully described from that time period. But rituals of, I guess you think of them as thought rituals. That's a compulsive kind of thought that the person engages in. And on from the outward, looking at them, they're not abnormal. They're not behaving in an odd way, but they're have these thoughts. And they have to kind of keep repeating the thoughts in terms of like a circle. Mm-hmm. And it's all in service of reducing their anxiety. Yeah. That's what is driving it.
The interesting thing that you're going to say more about this, I assume, but the interesting thing to me is that it increases their anxiety. It's all done in the service of reducing their anxiety, but in fact, it increases their anxiety. So they go round and around and around.
Exactly.
And the reason that you need specialized care is that it's just a different kind of patient who says, but I really do want to stab myself in the head. Well, then why haven't you? Whatever. You get into this battle with them of logic, which does not help at all. And they are terrified. I mean, they're terrified that they're going to do this thing despite all evidence to the contrary.
Right. So you're referring to what I call an intellectual spar. Many people with OCD are very intelligent, very creative, deep thinkers. And the last thing you want to do is get into an intellectual spar with them.
Mm-hmm. You will always lose.
But you're right. So rituals don't work, right? This is a disorder. This isn't, I touched something, I shook hands with someone who has the flu, I'm going to wash my hands, it's all done, right?
Right.
This is really about not having to feel discomfort. I feel uncomfortable and I want to escape this at all costs. Low confidence in an ability to be able to tolerate distress. Mm-hmm. And because they are reinforcing over and over and over that I need to do this ritual to feel better, you become dependent on the compulsions or the rituals. And they have to be done in a very specific way. So I'm going to be at the sink. I'm going to wash my hands. Everybody needs to be quiet. I have to have my special soap and I need to concentrate. And then, you wash your pinky 10 times. And then
first,
you're
pinky right, first.
Exactly. And then you proceed. And if you lose count, you have to start over. That is time consuming. You're late now for work. Your husband is yelling at you that you need to get out of the kitchen sink because he's trying to make dinner. The kids are arguing in the background. The tension builds. It's not reducing. And if it does reduce, it's fleeting. And then you have to do it again because people might say, but wait, did I really do it? It's a doubting disease. That's the nickname for OCD. Did I really do it the way I was supposed to do it? Wait a second. So I just walked away from the sink. Did I brush that thing again? I better go back to do it. So it's all building the problem, not taking it away. It's just people are so anxious that it's hard to get them to stop that pattern of behavior.
And before we get too far away from it, just to point out, Denise used a term called egosyntonic, and that people don't necessarily know what that means. It basically means that it doesn't generally bother them. It's syntonic. It goes along with their sense of themselves. It's gotten that habituated so that it doesn't bother them. Now, some of the symptoms can bother them and they could come in for treatment because they're distressed about this condition. But a good portion of the people with OCD, it's okay with them. And they get annoyed by others trying to say how crazy it is.
So in my experience, most people don't want it. It's unwanted and it's intrusive. But when you go into symptoms like body dysmorphic disorder or scrupulosity, those tend to be the more egosyntonic, which means It's consistent with who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. It's consistent with my morals and my beliefs. And those symptoms become harder to treat. But when you are talking about, like, I just had a newborn baby and I had this intrusive image of wanting to hurt my newborn baby, that is not egocentric. Yeah. That is dystonic. That is with who I am. I do not like this. I do not want this. And with treatment, again, which we'll get into a little bit later, you want to capitalize on that as a way to help build motivation.
I was wondering if you could sort of name a few more, if there's more. So we've covered scrupulosity, self-harm, harming others.
Yeah. So there's fear of causing self-harm to self. There's fear of causing harm to other people. There's violent and sexual intrusive thoughts. There's checking, like people who are checking to make sure that they didn't make a mistake. They didn't leave a stove on. They didn't leave a door unlocked. They didn't hit someone with their car. And then there's perfectionism, you know, people who have to do things the exact right way. Symmetry and perfectionism. Things need to be lined up. Things need to be ordered. There's also just right OCD, which is also a little bit more difficult to treat. It's when someone has to feel they do things a certain number of times until it feels right. So they may open and close the refrigerator door a bunch of times until it feels right. And the fear there is that if I don't get it to feel just right, that I'm going to feel so uncomfortable. It's never going to go away. I'm not going to be able to function with it. Mm. So those are the different categories.
We're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about obsessive compulsive disorder this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Denise Egan-Stack, who is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's also founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute. So we talked about one of the examples. Somebody shakes some hand with the flu and you're worried and you're going to wash your hands a million times because you want to get the flu. But it's more than that, because like most of it go, okay, well, if I get the flu, you know, I'll probably survive it. This is like something really, really bad is going to happen, right? And what's that feeling that they have?
Right. And it's not so if someone has a fear of getting sick, it's not just about like being in a room with someone who has the flu. It could be being in a room with someone who sniffles or has a little cough, or that they just don't look right, or they're touching things that they perceive to have germs. And so it's not just like the real deal. It's anything that feels like it might even be in contact with somebody mm-hmm. that might be sick. And so it really spreads. I mean, the triggers, the things that trigger the fear are widespread. And it's not just like, oh, darn, I don't want to get sick. It is like, it is intense. It is distressing. It is unrelenting. And people with OCD tend to have a sensitivity to anxiety and distress. So they really do not like it. Mm-hmm. They really want to avoid it. It's a disorder, yeah. Right? And so, and it, in like Mark was saying, there's, it's like a loop in the brain, right? And the thoughts get stuck in a loop. We call it like a sticky brain, and they go around and around and around.
It can't get out of it.
It cannot get out of it. It is, and then the more you're worried about it, the more energy you're feeding that loop. It can overtake everything. You know, that's where you're starting to see it's marked distress and impairment in people's lives. For kids, they're having a hard time in school. With adults, they're having a hard time at work or in their marriages. You know, OCD will take over a family.
Is there a genetic component to this?
There is. I mean, I think there's, you know, we don't know the exact cause or causes of OCD. Mark talked a little bit about the differences in brain structure. There are differences in genetics also of those affected by OCD. It's all new. Yeah. And it's not in one particular place. It's not like Huntington's where you can locate it on the genome and that's it. It's a series of different places, and they turn on and off with different things that happen in the world, like in your environment, that like stressful things, or even there's a type of OCD called PANDAS that is childhood OCD that is triggered by the body's reaction to infection.
Wow.
And then is it culturally informed, like those different types of OCD that you mentioned, are those informed by environment or something else? Like, it's very striking to me that across the world there's these very specific types, mm-hmm. but I wonder if scrupulosity comes up more in some cultures or counting comes up more in other cultures.
I don't think we have enough data to actually support that. I mean,
fair enough.
We are trying so hard at the International OCD Foundation to sort of fund research that's helping us with the DEI and multicultural, and it's just so in its infancy. But I think that what I have found anecdotally is that if you it's OCD can sort of attack what you care about. So if you are a religious person, it might go towards your religion. If you have just had a new baby, it might go towards motherhood. You know, when you're a little kid, you know, and if you want to be a good girl, it's going to go after your morality. And OCD symptoms can change over time. Like when I'm interviewing someone in a clinical assessment, it may have started off as contamination and then it went to perfectionism, you know, and now it's fear of causing harm to self. You know, symptoms can change over time.
So you mentioned that we see it in children. Is there an average age that we see this? And what does it look like in children?
Right. So as I mentioned before, it can really come up at any point in the lifespan, but we see it between like 8 and 12 and then late adolescence and in early adulthood. And with little kids, I mean, sometimes it's really hard for them to articulate what's actually happening. You might see the compulsions, you know, you might see the hand washing or the compulsive confessing. Today at school, I thought that someone was mean, or today at school, I talked when I wasn't supposed to. But it's a repetitive, compulsive behavior that like this is not normal, right? So little kids might have a bedtime routine, like, you know, we get your sippy cup and then we say good night to each other and we maybe read a book and like then you go to bed. Like that's a bedtime routine. It brings comfort. It's building a family. It's a nice thing. With kids with OCD, like, you have to say I love you the exact right way 10, 15, 20 times before the child feels ready. You think you've accomplished that. You go downstairs. The kids, you know, you're hoping your child is sleeping. They're going to call you in 5 minutes to come back up and do it again.
Yeah. I have rarely seen parents as exhausted and frustrated and confused as parents of young kids with OCD.
Right.
They're overwhelmed.
Right. Yeah. And so a lot of times children can't really tell you what the fear is, what the obsession is, but you're seeing it. You're seeing it in the behavior.
And do symptoms get worse as you age?
Well, I think so. I think that when you're treating a child, I like working with children. And when you treat a child and it's relatively new, I think that it's a little easier to treat, even though they can't really articulate the obsession, especially if you involve the family. I mean, when you're treating kids with pediatric OCD, you have to involve the family. Like that's just evidence-based. And the earlier you get a child into treatment, it's better prognostically. I just think that over the course of time, you're repeating behaviors. You're becoming dependent upon a set of behaviors and you're reinforcing this idea that I have to do these compulsions to feel better. That becomes a connection in your brain that is stronger and stronger with each passing year.
Fire together, wire together.
Obviously kids, like you're saying, might not be able to articulate it, but is there an awareness of these obsessions and compulsions of people who have it? In the last month, we talked about hoarding and some folks who don't think they have a problem. They're like, well, what's the problem? I like to collect things, right? So is it similar with OCD in that people go, why are you bothering me about washing my hands? I like to wash my hands. It's not a big deal.
Right. With hoarding disorder, I find that the majority of people have lower insight. And with OCD, I feel that the majority of people do have insight. I mean, a lot of times they don't know what they have, but they know it's off. There may be a lot of shame associated with the symptoms, especially if they're violent and sexual intrusive thoughts. But once you educate them, you know, they're relieved. They're grateful that there's a name for what they have. They're grateful that there's an evidence-based treatment, effective treatment for what they have. And so you can develop insight. They may not have it when they come in to see me or to see you, but they will gain insight and use that insight in treatment once you educate them about what it is that they have.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, just to go back a half beat, about what kinds of things parents could do when you're doing this family-based treatment.
Right. So one thing that happens as a parent, you are just wired to want to help your child feel better, to help your child be okay, right? But with OCD, some of the things that parents do are doing the exact opposite.
Right.
It's called family accommodation. Families get involved in the ritual. So families may like, well, mom, you know, we both touched that doorknob, so you need to wash your hands too. And you need to wash them according to my OCD rules. And parents are like, okay, my poor child is so distressed. Of course I'm going to do this to help them. And they're just doing what they think is the right thing to do. And then OCD will very quickly overtake the family. And so when you're working with kids with OCD, you have to work with families because you're helping the families extract themselves from the OCD rituals as well. So I think finding a provider that specializes in OCD and making the time to be a part of that OCD treatment as well. Because a lot of times anxiety runs in families, right? Mm-hmm. So there may be an anxious parent who needs to sort of manage their own anxiety to be able to extract themselves from the OCD rituals, because they have to let their kids sit in distress a little bit. That's really hard to do.
And it's really hard. I would think, you know, you're looking, you know, kids do weird things, right?
Right.
And so you're like, okay, is this just a weird kid thing or is this OCD? I can see where parents would be really confused.
Right. So developmentally, there's, you know, kids do have rituals that they engage in. Like I said, the bedtime ritual or bedtime routine. But that is something that brings joy and comfort, is soothing. When you see a kid with OCD, it is distressing. It is repetitive. It is rigid. There are often tantrums. Mm-hmm. It just looks very different. And so it's what's the function of the behavior? You know, mm-hmm. It's the function of the behavior. Like, it helps me go to sleep at night when mom comes in and reads me a story and says, I love you, versus I have to have you do it this way this many times in order for me to even, you know, conceive of sleep.
Right. So not being bossy, it's having issues with OCD.
Right. Yeah. It is a high level of distress, and they are just trying so hard to feel better.
And yeah. you can't soothe them. So that's, mm-hmm. that's, you know, again, this group, not only are these parents tend to be exhausted, but also at their wit's end, because mm-hmm. they do want to soothe their children and they cannot. And when they try to break the rituals, the children say, I hate you. You're mm-hmm. horrible. You're the worst. And so it does take a real effort on the yeah. parents' part to...
I'm wondering about the stigma with OCD, because, you know, you hear like some people, oh, I'm a little OCD, and they say it like it's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you really are OCD, it's not a good thing.
Right. I mean, I think that's in some ways that's done some good and it's done some bad, right? So if someone's like Khloe Kardashian's OCD cookie jar, which drives me crazy, you know, that has helped people feel like they could say that they have OCD and feel maybe less shame about it. So I think in some ways that's been helpful, but in other ways it's really trivialized mm-hmm. the difficulty that people with OCD have and live with. I mean, I can't overstate just how distressing it is. I mean, if you have a child that is in the shower for 6 hours, the water is turned freezing
oh
cold.
Goodness.
They are now washing their mouth out with soap because they believe that they have contaminated themselves with just the air from the school that they go to. Mm. If the school is contaminated, and dad is in there trying to help get him out. And I mean,
wow.
This is not just a little OCD. This is not...
Sibling has cooties.
Right.
But like real cooties.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
called emotional contamination. And it's another OCD symptom that people don't know a lot about. So if you have a brother who is feeling like the sister is contaminated, that wreaks havoc in a family. You can't eat dinner at the same dinner table. You can't drive together in the same car. You can't take vacations together and stay in the same hotel room.
Wow. I mean, yeah. Tough.
It's
yeah.
very tough.
Mark?
About the boundary between OCD and psychosis,
mm-hmm.
Because as you can tell, all these symptoms suggest the person's out of their mind. They've lost touch with reality. Reality doesn't matter. And so that brings up the state, you know, is this person have some kind of mental illness that makes them lose touch with reality? If it's OCD, the answer is generally no. There can be a psychotic disorder that has OCD as a symptom,
mm-hmm.
Just straight OCD is not a disorder where the person cannot test reality or lose contact with reality. They basically know what's real, what's mm-hmm. not, but they just are compelled to remain living in this loop, mm-hmm. This mental loop. Psychosis, on the other hand, is characterized by hallucinations, you know, where you see things that aren't there, hear things that aren't there, delusions, meaning false mm-hmm. beliefs. And, you know, you might say that OCD has at least borderline delusions with it. Psychosis is manifested by disorganized thinking. And generally, you know, that's not part of OCD. Mm-hmm. The other condition where OCD can co-occur is autism.
Oh, really?
People who are autistic or have a higher incidence of OCD, and people that are OCD have a higher incidence of autism. That's just the, you know, the statistical evidence. The difference there is that the autistic kids or people engage in self-stimulating behavior in an obsessive way and a repetitive, compulsive way. But they're doing it for the sensory stimulation and seeking anxiety relief through that sensory stimulation mode. OCD crosses other diagnostic categories because all these diagnostic categories are concerned with the same circuits in the brain, basically.
Yep. So up to 90% of people with OCD have co-occurring disorders.
I was going to ask you, what are some of the common co-occurring disorders?
Right. So depression, like major depressive disorder, another anxiety disorder, another like a related disorder, ADHD. And so it is very difficult diagnostically sometimes to figure out. So, for example, with co-occurring autism, what is OCD and what are the autistic behaviors? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times because people with autism may collect things, like if they become obsessed with trains, people think, well, that's OCD. It's like, no, that is autism. But then there may be people who have autism and OCD, and it might be contamination with that washing like we talked about. And those are separate. But clinically, you have to figure out, you know, what is what. There may be autistic behaviors that look like OCD. That is separate, and you need to know that. But then there are co-occurring things. Like Mark said, I'm treating someone right now who has OCD and psychosis. It can be very difficult to tease that out.
Yeah.
So you need to know what is what. But there are many people who've come to me that have been diagnosed with psychosis because some of these thoughts and behaviors seem, you know, so out of the realm of reality when in fact they just have OCD and it may be overvalued OCD.
Wow.
So it is important diagnostically that you know what you're dealing with because the medications are different, right. The treatments are different.
I can imagine you're diagnosed with psychosis and then you find out it's OCD. That might be a relief, even though OCD is not.
Right. That has happened a lot earlier. I think that clinicians now are much more aware of what OCD is, at least in this part of the country. Other parts of the country, it's quite dismal. But there are many people that maybe that are in their 40s and 50s, 60s now that may have started off with a psychosis diagnosis because people didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I find so many people who I'm stunned when they're put on psychotic medications. And I'm thinking, really? That's a big medication to put on someone who doesn't seem like they're having psychotic episodes.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Right. Yeah. Well, so sometimes
in your seat. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, advise Jenny to fasten her seatbelts because there really is a development in the profession of using antipsychotic drugs for reasons other than psychosis. To adjunct, primarily adjunct for depressive disorders. Mood disorders, and also for OCD, not necessarily because you think that the obsessions and or compulsions are bizarre and seem to be of psychotic levels, but just as an adjunct. We have these diagnostic categories that we talk about as if they have boundaries, specific boundaries. They have suggested boundaries. And there's a interplay between all of it because it all has to do with the brain. And the brain doesn't know boundaries of disorders. It knows what it knows.
Right. We'll sometimes use low-level psychotic. I'm not a psychiatrist. Mark is, so he's more of the authority on this. But anecdotally, on my caseload, psychiatrists will put people on low-level doses of antipsychotics to help clear up thinking if there is overvalued ideation, and also for mood management, especially when there's like rage and major emotional dysregulation. It's just used at a lower dose.
Yeah. We're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder. We'll talk more after the break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about obsessive-compulsive disorder this hour with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Denise Ingenstack, who's on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's also a founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute. So let's talk about diagnosis and treatment. First of all, you talked about how difficult sometimes this can be to diagnose. There isn't like a little area you can look in the brain. So what is the you know, somebody comes in, how do you diagnose if they have OCD?
Right. So it's mostly clinical interview, and you're asking for a history. And again, you're really looking for that interplay between obsessions and compulsions. Part of that diagnostic interview is assessing insight and whether or not people have good insight or poor insight and whether or not symptoms are overvalued. So that's where we blur the line between OCD and psychosis. Like, somewhere deep down, they know they don't have to do these things, but it gets a little blurry when people have high levels of emotion. With children, parents are always a part of that assessment, and sometimes schools as well. So we're really trying to look for that. Sometimes people have obsessions, but no compulsions, or they have compulsions, but no obsessions. And for the majority of times, there really has to be both.
That's people.
And the treatment, the evidence-based treatment, is something called exposure and response prevention. So we call it ERP, exposure and ritual prevention, exposure and response prevention. It is a cognitive behavioral therapy technique. So if you think about cognitive behavioral therapy as like an umbrella, ERP is a technique that is cognitive behavioral in nature that we use. And it's basically a face your fears therapy, which is why Mark said it's sometimes hard to treat. Mm-hmm. But it is effective. Up to 70% of people will get better or mostly better with this. But it's hard to do because you are asking people to face their fears, right? So if someone is washing their hands by these very strict rules, and parents are washing their hands and siblings are washing their hands, and now you're asking people to touch that doorknob and whatnot, wash their hands, it is very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So you have to really make sure that you're building insight and motivation, and you design behavioral experiments that are doable and that will help people understand that their worst fear does not come true. And if you can get people to actually approach the things that they're that make them anxious instead of avoiding the things that make them anxious, they will, you're testing out this hypothesis they have, they will find out that it's not as bad as they thought it was. Even if it is pretty bad, it doesn't last as long as they thought it would last. They manage better than they thought they would manage, and it feels so much better to actually tackle the thing than live a life in avoidance. And so there's an art form to it, and we have specific trainings for, you know, teaching clinicians on how to do it. But if you have OCD and you are seeking treatment, you need to make sure that your treater does ERP, exposure and response prevention.
And have you found that the target moves around? So they're afraid they're going to jump out of a car, so you have them sit in a car seat and notice that. And now they're afraid that they're going to stab themselves. They, you know, they're no longer afraid of cars, but right. now they're afraid they're going to hurt somebody else.
Right. So we sometimes call that whack-a-mole.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, and so that if you are not treating the underlying issue, which is discomfort of discomfort, if you are not teaching people how to sit in discomfort and get more comfortable being uncomfortable, it will just manifest itself all over the place. Mm-hmm. So OCD can look like almost anything, but the foundational issue is I avoid discomfort. I cannot deal with discomfort. I cannot sit in distress. So we always say you're helping people get more comfortable being uncomfortable.
Mm, and their discomfort, I mean, that's a lot of the job that I do with everybody,
right?
Extending that window of tolerance.
Right.
But again, I just want to emphasize that their level of discomfort, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I read years ago was that the amygdala, which is sort of the smoke alarm of the brain, is going nuts when you're having this. So it feels like there's a tiger running at you. It's not sort of like, I can't tolerate, sitting in traffic or something that we all feel, but it's like this, that actually their brain is telling them that the discomfort is way more.
Right. Yeah. That's disordered. Right. And so it is, I think a lot of times we think about it as anxiety, and I think most of the times it is anxiety, but can also be disgust.
Yeah.
Or
right.
Just a general sense right. of like, not things not being right, distress. So it is, again, we keep saying it over and over and over. This is what makes it a disorder. It is a very high level of distress that people with OCD feel that they have almost no capacity to tolerate, and they will search for ways to relieve themselves of that distress in the form of compulsions or rituals. And it becomes this self-reinforcing pattern that, like, you know, if you get triggered and your anxiety starts to peak and then you wash your hands, it brings it down immediately. You're like going to learn, like, washing my hands makes me feel better. But you have to do that over and over and over. It takes more and more hand washes. And then you have a real problem on your hands. The treatment is, as it starts to peak or gets high, you are supporting the person not washing their hands. It eventually comes down on the other side, or they eventually learn that that feared thing does not happen. That's what we want them to learn. That's where we change the connections in the brain. Mm-hmm. And it is powerful. It's powerful improvement. So when you do brain scans, the biochemical change in a brain of someone who's done ERP is the same as someone who's been on medication. Wow. So you are really changing the brain structures.
That's so amazing. Yeah, that really is incredible.
Got an email from Jennifer who says, have any of you heard about the use of microdosing with psilocybin for OCD? There are some well-reputed reports of helpful results.
Yeah, let me address that. I wanted to get around to that, too. One way of thinking of OCD is it's a fixed way of thinking, fixed, rigid, and repetitive, obviously. If that's a general characteristic, how do we change fixed ways of thinking? One of the biggest tools that we're now investigating and getting success with is the psychedelics. And the exact way and which one can have the best effect and safest is still to be determined. But what the emailer mentioned of microdosing with psilocybin, yes, it's been used and there's been some success, but it hasn't been tested yet or tested thoroughly enough to have it rise as the best way of doing it. So we're feeling our way around here. But the important thing is to intervene. We've talked about psychedelics before, and they can have a profound effect on rigid thinking and a way of opening up the mind to accept more possibilities, which is what the behavior therapy is doing. The other things that we use that have the same mechanism of action is ECT, electroshock therapy, and TMS, what Jonathan Schwartz does, magnetic therapy, magnetic stimulation. And that has been proven, and the FDA has approved TMS for OCD. And in that method, the parts of the brain that are triggered for stimulation of either for stimulation, and when I say stimulation, it can go one of two ways: more activity of the brain, or the result of stimulation is less activity of the brain. That's the way the brain works, a balance. The TMS is aimed at the areas that I mentioned are involved, the three areas, cortex, primarily the lower areas, the striatum and the thalamus, or the two subcortical areas. And what it's doing, it's just altering the habitual wiring in a biological way. It's relatively nonspecific. Say that, but ECT has been around since the 1930s. It does it, and it occasionally is used for very severe OCD.
Go ahead.
Right. So, in summary, the treatment for OCD is cognitive therapy, exposure and response prevention, and or medication, some combination of both, and neurotherapeutics. And that's sort of what Mark was talking about. So there's deep brain stimulation, which is FDA approved for OCD, TMS, FDA approved for OCD, and a range of others.
Yeah. Got an email from Joy who says, my son was diagnosed with non-religious, I can't even say the word,
scrupulosity.
Thank you. And social anxiety disorder as a young adult. It was completely debilitating to the point that he couldn't get out of bed, and it derailed his high school experience. One of the major challenges as a parent was that the origins of his discomfort were invisible, and many of the normal expectations and approaches to motivate him to go to school actually made his condition worse.
Right.
Fortunately, he found help from exposure response prevention therapy through the Cognitive Behavior Institute in Falmouth, and then with a dialectic behavior therapy at McLean Southeast. I'm so happy to report that he is now on track and healthy with amazing coping skills. Joy, that's such good news.
Yay.
But what Joy says, I really want listeners to know that caregiver support is available on CAPE to learn how to understand and use these DBT skills too. There's a free support group led by Lisa McGillicuddy that meets weekly at the First Congregational Church on the Green in Falmouth. And then she says folks can also join by Zoom. It helps to know that others are dealing with similar issues, whether it's OCD, anxiety, or depression disorders, and learn from people experienced with effective coping skills. Joy, thank you for sharing. So glad her that her
that
son
is
doing
so
well.
Denise,
great.
Can you say something about telehealth and OCD treatment?
Before you do, I want to say, but I also want to say thank you. And parents end up being the most amazing experts often in these fields. And if you can connect with another parent who has gone through this, it can
great.
Just be
very
life-changing.
Helpful, yeah.
So at the International OCD Foundation, we are basically building programs for people with OCD and those affected by OCD. We have tons of parent support. Listserv, conferences, etc. So iocdf.org is a great place to look for that. So exposure and response prevention. Prior to COVID, I only did treatment in people's homes because that is where symptoms are occurring.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going into the home. I'm seeing the interplay with the family. I'm helping the person touch the things they don't want to touch. COVID occurs. My model of treatment has changed. Yes. So I'm doing a lot of that on Zoom now. But you know, the good thing about that is I can still be in the person's kitchen or the bathroom. We can just take the computer or the phone with us. And it really is about supporting the person in that moment. It's not just about someone comes in a session, tells me what they did or didn't do. We talk about it and then we, you know, give homework and we go to the next session. It's we're doing those things together. We can, I find most effective in person. But telehealth I think is also effective.
Another quick question. Do we know if people who lived hundreds of years ago suffered from OCD or is this a affliction something new? We think they did, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mark spoke to that earlier.
Yeah. Just got about a minute and a half left. Final thoughts?
I think that this is a common disorder. I think that it is widely misunderstood, but I think the good news is that there are very effective treatments for it. There's a lot of evidence to support its effectiveness. I think that there are wonderful books and workbooks. If you cannot find a treater who treats people with OCD, you can buy a workbook for you and your therapist. You can go through it together. I do think it's super important to know that families have to be a part of that treatment. If you live with someone or you have supportive people in your life, OCD has probably infiltrated those relationships, and you want to make sure that the person you're working with will work with your family as well.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Ditto.
Sorry, I was just listening for once. I wasn't thinking about something to say.
Right. Mark, your final thoughts?
Advise people. Nowadays, it's very hard to find a therapist for anything. But online resources are excellent to start with.
Right, and OCD.
I also think people need to think about, you know, they've had this for a while and it might take a while for them to get the therapist, but keep at it. Yeah. If you don't get it in the next minute or, you know, the next week or the next 3 months, it's okay. Eventually you'll get it.
Read about it. Get a workbook.
Yeah. All right. Denise Higginstack is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board, founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute. Also with us, social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you all. Very fascinating. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.